This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, you know, it was going to be one of those normal weeks when Janet Yellen was on Capitol Hill, and the whole discussion would be about what she really said about raising or lowering rates and how we interpret that. But lo and behold, something to talk about other than the Fed as a result of the Brexit vote, which took place our time on the North American continent. And we began following it in the evening. Of course, it was much, much later in the early morning by the time it rolled around on UK time. I also did find it amusing, Jim, that the movie London Has Fallen has been premiering on the cable movie channel.
I watched that this week.
Yeah, it's one of those fun movies, you know.
But you know what was really interesting is, okay, the vote was on Thursday, and of course, they're 8 hours ahead of us here on the West Coast. There's a couple news shows I usually watch in the evening around dinner time. So I recorded a couple news shows, and I was watching them, and I left at the end of watching the evening news with the idea that they remained, because the early exit polls, everything was telling us that the vote was shifting to remain. And so I basically walked away and said, oh, okay. And if you're listening to this program, that's what the markets thought too, because the markets were up on Thursday. Gold was selling off over the last couple of days. Big commercial short position because everybody thought that Britain would remain. And so I left watching television thinking everything is calm. The markets anticipated. The markets had been up on Thursday. So I'm sitting in my library and I'm reading. And I'm thinking, oh, that's about 7:30, 8 o'clock. Why don't I turn into Bloomberg Television, because you can get Bloomberg Asia and just find out how the markets are reacting given the fact that, you know, Britain remained. And I turned on Bloomberg Television. And when I first turned it on, it was the same story. That the Remain story was the prominent one. So it was lining up with the evening news. It was lining up with the polls. And then all of a sudden, Bloomberg was doing these algorithms. And about a half an hour of watching, all of a sudden, the trading screens began to flip. The algorithm started leaning more towards exit. And within an hour, you had the BBC declaring that the exit votes had won. And John, it was pandemonium in the markets. It was the most fascinating thing to watch if you were watching this last night. I mean, at one point, the Dow Jones Industrial Average in the futures market was down over 700 points. The S&P was down 120 points. I think gold was up almost $80. Silver was over 18. The British sterling was down and still ended up low at its lowest point since 1985. But it just goes to show you how interconnected we are today with markets globally, because in that half hour, everything shifted from the way the markets closed on Thursday. And it was just pandemonium. I remember at one point they were talking, the trade desks were so busy that the traders couldn't even get away from their desks for dinner. They were bringing coffee. And I finally went to bed about 1 o'clock. And I thought the Dow, at least the futures market, which can go all over the place at night, was down over 700 points. So I thought, well, this is going to be a pretty ugly opening for the market. The Dow would be down 4 or 5% at the opening bell. And as it turned out, we were down around 500 points. We got down to 300 before finishing down 600 for the day. But it is amazing, John, how you were led, or at least the news media and the media elites, gave one the impression that the British were going to vote to stay within the euro. And that's what the polls said. And this is one of the reasons why I think, John, sometimes how polls have been so off. I mean, a good example is this year's presidential election, where we've had outcomes that have just surprised everybody, both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. But here it was, the media and the elites were giving you the impression, and at least when I watched the evening news last night, given what the markets had closed, I thought, okay, they decided to stay. And then all of a sudden, when the reality set in and the votes came in, how pandemonium set into the markets.
The one thing I think we really need to break out, first of all, has been the winners and losers in this, because contrary to all of the hype about, you know, this is all falling, etc., some people did win in this.
Well, I mean, if there was any winners on this, it was the safety trade. I mean, gold had its biggest pop that we've seen since April of 2014. At one point, gold was up close to $80. Treasury yields, at least last night, Treasury yields got down, John, to 1.4%. You know, they're closer to 1.57. So it was a safety trade. Where do you land? Where do I go for safety? And so we've gone from these markets, which have been kind of the risk-on trade, we went immediately to the risk-off trade. And the biggest winners at the end of the day was the U.S. dollar, U.S. treasuries, and gold. Because markets were hammered, oil was down, other commodities were down, foreign currencies were down. I mean, it was a chaotic day in the markets, but it was definitely back to the risk-off trade at the end of the day.
All right, now that the particles and dust are starting to settle a bit, what would you say are the broader implications now that the frenzy's over?
I would say, first of all, there's a lot that goes on just with this vote. For example, now that they voted to exit the euro, it's not that easy because there is a process of exiting. And this gets back to invoking Article 50 of the European Governing Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty. And there are a lot of rules that go into here that could really complicate it. It requires any member must notify the European Council of its intention to leave, and then they negotiate a withdrawal agreement taking account of the framework for any kind of future relationship, for example, that Britain would have with the EU. And that agreement must be approved by a qualified majority of the European Council after Europe's Parliament consent. That is 55% of the European Council and 65% of the EU's population represented. Now, if the EU and the exiting state have not forged an agreement within 2 years after notification, then the relationship ends automatically, which would be sort of chaotic. And what happens is the European Council would have to vote unanimously to extend the negotiation period if they couldn't reach an exit plan within 2 years. So if that was to happen, the UK would probably lose some of its negotiating leverage. And here's the tricky part. The exit agreement, you know, what is it going to look like? Is the UK, are they going to follow the model, for example, with Switzerland, Norway, Iceland, Canada to maintain, let's say, a trading relationship with the EU? I mean, Brexit would involve all kinds of negotiations from short-term settlement of accounts to long-term initiatives to integrate, let's say, EU laws into British law and renegotiate trade agreements with third parties. So it's not just that easy. People say, okay, they just voted to exit. Well, it's like you've got this contract, you have this integration. How do we unwind that? And so, John, that's a process that can go on for 2 years.
Well, it's been interesting also the speculation about a domino effect with other member states of the European Union leaving. You know, they're talking about a nexit, meaning the Netherlands exiting and some of the other exits put together. Let's hear what former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan had to say about this.
Well, I think the euro currency is the immediate problem. The euro currency, remember, occurs in history as a bridge to go from essentially where we were in the early post-World War II period to a political merging of Europe. The obvious problem that everyone has had with France and Germany is they went to war with each other several times, and it's been a major problem in Europe. The result is that starting right from the Iron and Steel Agreement and Adenauer and de Gaulle, there's this whole movement towards European political integration. The euro area, I should say, was a major step in that direction, and it's failing.
Yes.
It's failing in the sense that, for example, we can't have, Greece is in real serious trouble. It is not going to continue in the euro for very much longer, irrespective of what is going on currently.
Yeah, so there are more earthquakes to come for the euro, which may be a salvation for Great Britain if the pound is separated, you know, which they never really joined into the euro per se.
Yeah, it's not only Greece, but there's some anti-EU movements, both in Italy and Spain. There could be several other countries that back out of it. So, you know, the union was never held that strong. It was not a unified body like the 50 states of the United States. I mean, they weren't integrated. They were integrated through the currency markets and through their central bank, but they didn't have taxing authority. They didn't have many of the things that, let's say, the U.S. government has with its treasury in integration with our central bank, as well as fiscal policy. I mean, there were a bunch of rules and regulations, and I guess the Brits said, you know what, this is hamstringing our economy. The people didn't like it. They didn't like it from immigration to trade to a number of things. And you notice, John, what is happening here, it almost seems like this is getting universal. You're seeing a revolution almost take place in Venezuela. You're seeing a lot of individuals and member states within the EU that are now talking about an exit. So I got a feeling we're going to be going through a convulsive period of time. As I mentioned, this is something that now that they voted to exit, there's a process that takes place. There's a contract that has to be unwound. There's trade agreements. There's all kinds of complications that are going to go forward here.
Yeah, now I'm looking forward and trying to put all of this together and determine what those things are that might be important that we should be watching that will be a result of this.
Well, there are a number of things. And, you know, one of the things that you can do as an investor is not overreact. When you have this kind of severe reaction in the market, as we saw in the last 24 hours, unless you're a very astute trader, usually, you know, you're best to sit on the sidelines and wait till this thing settles down. Unless you made your moves beforehand, for example, like George Soros, he shorted the British pound and invested in gold. So Soros probably made another few billion this week. But what to watch afterwards? I think Scottish independence, around 44% of Scots still wish to declare independence, and Brexit would give them a new opportunity to secede. This time, the EU might not be so cold towards the Scottish secession. I mean, the British Isles as a whole would see an increase in political risk as tensions in Northern Ireland could also flare up. The other thing is going to matter here is what happens between the political parties in Britain. Obviously, the Prime Minister Cameron resigned. And what replaces him? What steps in? Can Labour rally? And if Labour goes in other words, what takes place? Is it going back to Labour restrictions, taxation, all the kind of things that the Labour Party wants to do? Or is it Thatcherism? And quite honestly, we have no idea at this time. Can the Labour rally behind Corbyn if the Tories disintegrate? And then the other thing, as you brought up, John, is wider Europe. A lot of people believe that, as you heard Greenspan, is this could mark the beginning of the end of the euro bloc and disintegration. So the question that the markets are going to be asking, who's next? Is it Greece? Is it Spain? Spain's Podemos party, Italy's five-star movement, and their positions on the euro. So there is a growing exit movement within Europe itself. And so, you know, it's amazing. We had the pig crisis in 2011. Then we had Draghi come in and basically bring out the bazookas and throw, you know, everything he could at the wall to see if something would stick. And, you know, it was successful. Greek bond yields dropped from 30% down to 8% where they are today. It's hard to believe Spanish and Italian bond yields are actually lower than U.S. bond yields. But that was the crisis in 2011. It went away with a lot of money printing, a lot of quantitative easing. But Europe has a moribund economy. They have high unemployment. Overall unemployment is over 10%. Youth unemployment over 25%. Their economy has been in and out of recession several times. The one good thing about the U.S. is, although economic growth here in the U.S. has been anemic under Obama, you know, 1 and 2% economic growth rates are better than recessions or zero growth rates. Although I think the U.S. is headed for a recession, and we'll explain why. But there are a lot of implications for all of this, John. It just doesn't end today. And quite honestly, nobody knows what the political outcome or the economic outcome at this point will be. It is going to be a process. And it's just one more element of volatility and uncertainty that is injected into the markets, which is why you saw that flight to safety beginning on late Thursday night into the bond markets, especially U.S. Treasuries. The U.S. dollar is a safe haven and gold. So it's back to, we just went from risk on to the risk off trade. And I think we're going to remain there for a while.
Economic growth has been uneven over recent quarters. U.S. inflation-adjusted GDP is currently estimated to have increased at an annual rate of only 0.75% in the first quarter of this year. Subdued foreign growth and the appreciation of the dollar weighed on exports, while the energy sector was hard hit by the steep drop in oil prices since mid-2014. In addition, business investment outside of the energy sector was surprisingly weak. However, the available indicators point to a noticeable step up in GDP growth in the second quarter. In particular, consumer spending has picked up smartly in recent months, supported by solid growth in real disposable income and the ongoing effects of the increases in household wealth. And housing has continued to recover gradually, aided by income gains and the very low level of mortgage rates. The recent pickup in household spending, together with underlying conditions that are favorable for growth, lead me to be optimistic that we will see further improvements in the labor market and the economy more broadly over the next few years.
This week, Janet Yellen was on Capitol Hill. Anybody remember that? After the Brexit vote, it all seemed to evaporate. But you know, Jim, she was not really very sanguine on the way things are shaping up economically. And one of the things you mentioned earlier on was that the dollar is one of the beneficiaries of everything going on. So what are the implications now for Fed policy and for where our currency is headed?
Well, I mean, she's talking about a lot of these headwinds. I mean, you just take a look at some of the economic numbers that came out. Durable goods was awful. The arbiter of recessions, which is the Business Cycle Committee or the National Bureau of Economic Research, article in the Wall Street Journal this week that sees clouds on the horizon for the U.S. economy. You had the IMF come out this week and lower economic growth for the United States. And there were several articles that the risk of a recession is increasingly becoming more likely here in the U.S. And so what does this mean? Well, one of the things that Yellen talked about, and there was a lot of speculation in terms of going into the June meeting with the Brexit, for good reason, that it was unlikely that the Fed would do anything, which they didn't. And then, of course, everything shifted over to the July meeting. John, my prediction is if the Fed raises rates this year, it will be one, if anything, and it won't be until December if they do. They're certainly not going to go in July, given what's happened here in the last 24 hours. That's out the door. We're seeing continued economic weakness. We're getting more weakness on the economic front. I don't care if you're looking at jobs, durable goods, looking at manufacturing, hours worked. Everything is pointing to a slowdown in the economy. And what that means, that's putting the Fed on hold. And on top of that, John, I mean, you think about it. They spent a whole year last year prepping the market, and they could only raise rates a quarter of a point. They raised it in December, and we start out the beginning of the year with stocks falling every single week for 2 months. I just don't think you're going to see a Federal Reserve, with Yellen being a very staunch Democrat, do anything like that September, 2 months prior to a presidential election. So forget the July rate hike. Forget the September rate hike. And you may even have to forget the December rate hike if economic conditions continue to deteriorate as they are right now. So you had NIBR, which is the official agency that pronounces U.S. recessions. Usually they're probably 8 to 9 months after an actual recession begins, but they're saying they're starting to see clouds on the horizon. The World Bank, the IMF, all the major institutions are saying economic growth is slowing. Now, of course, you're not going to have a Fed chairman go up in front of a committee and say, you know what, I think we're heading for a recession. You're never going to hear that from a Fed because that would create panic in the market. But, you know, they're looking at the same data we're seeing, and they have better access to data than we do, and they get it sooner than we do. So if we're looking at this and we're seeing a recession, you can imagine what's going in the minds of Federal Reserve governors. Have you noticed they've gone more dovish lately? And they're all in unison at the last meeting in terms of what they wanted to do in terms of policy. So what does this mean? I doubt, if anything, even if we get one rate increase, I don't know. I just don't see it. I don't see anything happening until December. As I mentioned, I don't see it happening in July and certainly not in September. So it's going to have to come in December if they do. And what does this mean with the strong dollar, with all the kind of fluctuations and the uncertainties that are now being created as a result of Brexit? What it means is the risk-off trade is going to be on, and what people are going to be doing is they're going to be looking for islands of safety. We saw it on Friday. We saw it in the dollar. We saw it in treasuries and sovereigns. Bond yields dipped even lower. And also, given the fact that the Fed won't be able to raise interest rates, that means rates are going to remain lower. I mean, we did a show on this, John, about 3 weeks ago, talking about the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. I'm getting ready to write an article showing interest rates going back to King Hammurabi. And John, we've never seen them this low. And just whenever you think they're low and can't go any lower, they go lower, as we did on Friday when U.S. Treasuries hit 1.4% on the 10-year Treasury. So I think those high dividend-paying stocks are going to look very attractive here, especially utilities, telecom, things that have high dividend yields, because rates are going to go lower. And everywhere you look, I don't care if it's globally or it's here in the U.S., there's definitely a trend that is in motion right now and has now become a trend, and that is weakening economic growth. You see it. We've been looking at this for, what, almost 7 or 8 months since the fourth quarter of last year. That trend continues. It's a little better in the second quarter, but John, not by much. We're seeing the labor markets weaken. We've seen corporate profits peak. That's something we'll be watching here in this month as corporations begin to release earnings next month. And so the implications here, John, it is the risk-off trade. There's just too much uncertainty right now.
And I think, Jim, though, you're not in bad company, because there are other people who are sharing the same concerns. This is what Bill Gross had to say.
There's going to be more unrest and there's going to be more protest. We can, you know, pick the individual countries that are at risk that, you know, have populist movements. It could be in France. It could be in Italy. It could be in, you know, the South America. It could be in North America with Trump and his populist stature, at least in terms of several of the policies that, you know, populists seem to be advocating, which are related to trade and which are related to immigration. And like I said, maybe even taxes. And so, you know, the people have sort of stormed the gates of the city, quote unquote, with a cap, meaning London. And they're with a bare margin, of course, but they're making a statement that times have to change. Those statements have been made before, but now we see an election in which, you know, it mandates some sort of change.
If you look around the globe, you're finding a lot of similarities. We have things going on in Venezuela. Of course, it's a little drastic in Venezuela right now, given the shambles that Chavez and Maduro have left that country in. But if you look at the issues that happen in Great Britain and why the people are upset, they feel they've been lied to. They feel they've been led along roads of agendas that they haven't been told the total truth about when they get started on it. There's an immigration problem with that. There's unelected, faceless bureaucrats running their lives. Identical issues to what we're facing here in the United States. So a lot of what we're seeing here has sort of global echoes, and we may replay this whole thing in November here.
John, I think you're spot on. And I think something that you have to be aware of is what the polls are saying. And I used to do polling when I was in college in my undergraduate degree. In some of the stat courses, we did a lot of political polling. And John, you know, you can change the outcome of a poll by the way you ask the questions and the people who you ask them. And like I said, I mean, I literally Thursday, given what happened in the markets and the way they closed, watching the evening news, given on polling and exit polling, it looked like Britain was going to remain. And John, the polls were off. And how many times have we seen that throughout this election this year, where what the polls told us on one possible result on an election, it turned out much different?
Yeah, the overall sentiment, whether we deal with the European Union or here, is that we've been on these utopian experiments for the last 50 years, and it has left a lot of wreckage in its wake. But the utopiites, okay, that are pursuing this want to keep on going. It's like, well, this is collateral damage. We just have to do this because we're pushing through to the great dream. And meanwhile, the people are believing that their politicians are out of touch, their bureaucrats are unaccountable, They're not hearing what the people are facing, and they don't seem to care. And that goes all the way from Obamacare to loss in wages to terrorism to immigration to all of this politically correct glop that we have to deal with all of the time.
Well, it's not just that. There's so many things that are going on right now. You had globalization, you had the integration, and you really saw that last night in the marketplace, where instantaneously every single market that you could trade in, I don't care if it was stocks, bonds, commodities, or currencies, all convulsed at the same time as trading screens in an interconnected world just went haywire. And the thing is, we have technology, which is changing the way we live and bringing about vast changes in the way the economy works. And there really is a growing feeling that, you know, our politicians aren't in touch with the people themselves. And the real risk there, though, John, is when you have chaos and uncertainty, and the longer that it persists, there's two ways that you can have. You can have a benign outcome, or you can end up in a dictatorship. And look what happened in Venezuela. There's a real danger here when there is a lot of chaos, because, I mean, you take a look at some of the solutions that are being offered right now. We've seen in this year's election, free medical, free school, free college, all this free stuff. And we simply don't have the money to pay for all this stuff, just like the country of Greece is finding out that, you know, if nobody else is going to lend you money, you can't have all this free stuff. And I do believe that Greenspan is right. I think one of the next victims is going to be Greece itself. So we are entering, as people call it, the new normal, but we're also entering a period of volatility and uncertainty. And that's why this is going to be a much more difficult market to play going forward. And that's why, as we've been talking about here in the program, this is a time that you don't want to be bold. This is a time you want to be cautious. This is a time you want to have some cash. This is some time that you want to look at something that's stable. And this is the kind of market that we're going to be in. Now, you can make bold moves like Soros did, where he shorted the pound and he went into gold. But he's a big long-term macro thinker. And at this point, I think unless you're willing to trade in and out of markets like him, you need to do something that is more on the cautious side and something more strategic and longer term.
You know, what you're describing, by the way, matches what Strauss and Howe have been saying in the fourth turning, that you come up to this fourth turning crisis and you have a choice. You can either reform and continue on, or it degenerates into chaos. And it's a question of how you handle it. But, you know, since last November, I know you've been going a lot more cautious, frequently warning our listeners that the macro environment is changing. So here we are in this changing environment. What do we do then?
In this kind of environment, I still like short-term bonds. I just would not buy sovereigns down here unless you're a trader. Because when you get interest rates this low, you know, granted, they've gotten lower in this crisis. A good example is what happened to Treasuries on Friday. But I like short-term corporate bonds in, you know, anywhere from maturities 1, 2, 3 years. So you can roll them over, especially corporate bonds, because the spread over Treasuries is much, much higher. It's a nice place that you can get a fairly decent return. I still like high dividend paying stocks, and I would use any kind of pullback that we've seen here in a day like today or this week as an opportunity to pick up on some high dividend payers. Because as we talked about on the program last week, most of your returns going forward here are going to come more from the interest you receive on your bonds and the dividends you receive on your stocks. I also like gold here. This is an ideal environment for gold, as Dave Morgan and I talked about in the first hour, and as my good friend Keith Barron and I are going to talk about coming up next as we take a look at the gold market. And, you know, I mean, George Soros has made a big bet on gold because he sees currency chaos as central banks debase their currency, and the purchasing power of money loses its value in terms of return. And that's what I think you're going to have to play in this kind of market, and invest strategically and follow the macro environment, John, because it is changing. One of the characteristics that we've seen in this economic recovery is, number one, we've had poor fiscal policy, which is one of the reasons why we've had stagnant economic growth. Secondly, we've had this whole event take place globally at different stages. It began in the U.S., then it went to Europe, shifted to Europe, and now it's shifting to Asia as we're seeing it in China. China is another house of cards waiting to fall, and eventually that will come there. So this is a different environment we're going to play in, and I predict, John, I don't care if it's Secretary of State Clinton or it's Donald Trump as president, the next president, we're going to see helicopter drops. What we're going to see is fiscal policy combined with monetary policy, meaning the government will cut taxes, they will spend money, and the Fed will simply monetize it, because the Fed has really run out of a lot of ammunition, and the efficacy of Fed policy moves are becoming ineffectual, as we saw with Japan with negative interest rates in February. Instead of stimulating the economy, people put their money in mattresses, safes, or they bought gold. And so I would look for massive fiscal policy coming with the next president of the United States. I think you're going to see it elsewhere in Europe and also in Asia, as the Chinese are now doing. And I think eventually it is going to breed and spell higher rates of inflation in the days ahead. And that's why I think the kind of investments that you're going to want to be hedged, you're going to be short-term, you want to be cautious, because look how many times, John, since the beginning of the year, we began the year with the risk-off trade. The market was down, commodity prices were down. The only thing that was doing well was treasuries. Then all of a sudden, we went to the risk-on trade. Oil prices doubled. They went from 26 to over 50. Gold prices went from below 1,100 to where they are today, over 1,300. And it was the risk-on trade. The market got back up several times to 2,100, which we got there this week. And look where we are now. And so we're seeing these rapid rotations, and I just think that's going to be the characteristic of this market going forward over the next couple of years. It's going to be a very, very difficult market to navigate. You're going to have to be a lot more nimble, a lot more diversified and hedge than you've ever been before.
And Keith Barron will weigh in with us next as the big picture continues on the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Why did the U.S. become the world's largest economy and a global superpower? Was it because of our strong work ethic, Judeo-Christian heritage, or geography? According to our next guest, Peter Zion, author of the phenomenal book, The Accidental Superpower, that is indeed the case. The world's largest economy, the U.S., is blessed with a very unique set of resources that set the stage for becoming a global superpower. So would you mind telling our audience a little bit about what set up the U.S. and how geography played a role?
There's a lengthy list of reasons as to why the United States is the global superpower. Everything from having a great port system to the greater Midwest to strategic isolation versus the rest of the planet. Having ocean moats, it's really hard to beat that one. But the number one factor, the single most important factor, is the greater Mississippi system. It perfectly overlays some of the densest economic territory that the Americans have directly over the Midwest. And it's got some extensions in other river systems and with the intercoastal that go right up into our population core on the East Coast. Water transport is what it's all about. About 90% of international trade is transported to the water. And in the United States, historically, over half of our internal trade has been on the water. And if you float something from A to B, it costs only about 1/13 what it costs to move it by truck. And that has given the United States a massive leg up on all competition everywhere else in the world in terms of generating a stable, prosperous, and growing agricultural, industrial, and financial core. And if you get that right, the rest of it's easy.
Well, what an interesting way to end the week. If there was a winner of anything on Friday, it was gold, the dollar, in sovereign bonds. Joining me on the program is Keith Barron. He's president and chairman of Urania. Keith, you're in Europe, And it was amazing. On Thursday night, I was watching the evening news shows, and they basically said Britain was going to remain. But then a couple hours later, I thought, well, I'll turn on Bloomberg Television because they follow the markets overseas. And within half an hour of watching, they were running algorithms, and it flipped to an exit. And it was probably the most fascinating trading I've ever seen. Trade desks around the world were gyrating in a way we haven't seen. Probably you'd have to go back to the financial crisis. The pound was down 10%. At one point, gold prices were up nearly $80. Silver was skyrocketing in the futures market. The S&P was down 5% along with the Dow. Give me a feeling, since you live in Europe, what's the feeling there about Brexit?
Well, actually, I'm on the telephone from Montana, USA right now. I'm at my gold and sapphire mine. But I do live in Europe. I live in Switzerland. And like you, I was glued to the media all last night, intently watching things as they unfolded. I actually am a UK passport holder, so I have a vested interest in the outcome of the Brexit. And I think what's happened, I really didn't expect the results. The media was taken by surprise. And I think that a lot of people were betting on the wrong side. They were on the wrong side of the trade. They were shorting gold, expecting the Remain to win. And obviously it didn't happen, and so we've seen a lot of turmoil in the markets when they opened this morning. Essentially, I lived in Britain for a number of years, and I have lots of relatives there, and the story that I get from my friends and family there is that a lot of Brits are very upset with the number of Eastern Europeans who have moved into Britain. This is something that really the politically correct mob don't talk about too much. But the British perceive that a lot of their jobs have been taken away by the Poles, the Romanians, Bulgarians. They were assured when these countries joined the EU that only about 10,000 or 20,000 migrants would be headed to Britain, and in fact over a million showed up. So they're there, and the Brits are a little bit upset about the whole thing. They're also upset about this so-called jungle outside Calais, where they're are tens of thousands of North Africans waiting to find some way to get through the Channel Tunnel to Britain. And they don't think that the French have been doing an adequate job of protecting the border there. So I think that a lot of people have a legitimate beef, and this is the reason I believe that the British have chosen to pull out of the EU. And I think that this is only the thin edge of the wedge. So there is going to be a vote coming up in Holland. I could see countries like Finland leaving, there's a lot of discontent, and it's not just to do with migrants, but it's also got to do with some of the richer countries financing the pig countries, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And, you know, their economies are all very, very poor, and they think that their wealth is being squandered on some of these countries that can't pay their bills. So I expect to see a lot more volatility coming up for the euro, for other currencies as well. And I think it's long-term very, very bullish for the precious metals, especially gold.
Well, it's interesting because two of the clear winners were, I mean, Treasury bond yields are got down to 1.4%, the lowest that we've seen. We even seen that on sovereign bonds. And, of course, gold is doing quite well under these circumstances. Keith, let's talk about the gold market. You've been heavily involved in it from a company and exploration point of view. Where do you see gold going here? To me, with negative interest rates, it's a catalyst for gold, but also with countries trying to depreciate their currency, I don't care if it's quantitative easing in Europe or it's in Japan, they're, you know, gold is the ultimate currency and the ultimate asset class in times of turmoil, which it proved itself very much last night. As soon as the market switched, it was amazing because gold was going down the last couple days on the news that Britain would remain. The minute that that switched last night, gold shot through the roof, because I know in the futures market, commercials were heavily short.
Mm-hmm, yes. Well, I do believe that the international finance market is quite fragile. And with all the quantitative easing that's been going on and negative interest rates and everything, the powers that be don't seem to be able to stimulate any of these economies. You know, with interest rates at historic lows to borrow money, you should see an incredible boom and an unprecedented boom that we've never seen in the whole of recorded history. And instead, we've seen deflation. We've seen really a bust, stagnation. And I think I'm going to be writing a piece quite soon on the helicopter drop of money, which I expect is going to be the next thing, because QE doesn't seem to be working. And so they're just going to print money and willy-nilly give it to people to try to jumpstart the consumer market. So I think that all these things are really very inflation-causing, and at some point, inflation is going to pick up, and you'll see the results of all this wanton money printing that's gone on. I think the system is very, very fragile. I think when you flex it too many times, and we're certainly doing that today after the Brexit vote, you'll see portions of it break. And I think it's very vulnerable. And so I think this is one of the reasons why people are going towards safe havens. And certainly precious metals are a safe haven, more so now than perhaps in the last couple of years. You know, after the banking crisis in 2008, we saw the gold price shoot up and then go down precipitously. Now we're in a situation where a lot of countries have negative interest rates. The Germans have it now. And really, what do? You don't put your money into the bank, because you're going to have to pay the bank for that privilege. So you're seeing a lot of people putting their money into precious metals. And I think certainly this is a continuance. Countries like Russia and countries like China don't really trust the dollar so much, and they're continuing to liquidate dollars and change them into precious metals.
You know, let's talk about the precious metals market, because after reaching 1900, we saw, as you talked about, a precipitous decline that lasted almost 3.5 years, a bear market. In fact, in February this year, gold got below 1100, the lowest we've seen in years. And then things began to turn around. Gold began to go up as fears over what was happening in the global markets with China, credit spreads, everything else that was going on. Now gold is starting to go up. But Keith, let's talk about the gold industry, because a lot of mines have been shuttered. There hasn't been a lot of exploration done because there's been no money to do it. Nobody wanted to fund any mining or exploration company. Let's talk about the state of the industry now. Should, let's say, gold resume its upward trajectory?
Yeah, well, we're at a very, very interesting juncture right now. Really, since the very first week of January of this year, the shares in mining companies have started to take off. And we've seen incredible gains in the HUI. We're even seeing tremendous movements in the juniors, which we haven't seen for 4 or 5 years now. So there's a general feeling out there that we are heading towards higher gold prices. And the senior producers have been through a lot of hardship over the last couple of years, and they've now become quite lean and mean. And they've cut away a lot of the fat. They've got rid of projects with dubious economics. And now they're focused very much on cash flow and making money. Prior to that, it was really a feeling in the industry that you had to be the biggest, to be the best, to attract the funds, the fund managers. And so a lot of the majors loaded up with projects that simply had ounces in the ground, but not necessarily profitable ounces. So they were growing for growth's sake, and not really paying attention to the bottom line. And we saw shareholder revolts. We saw a tremendous upheaval in the mining industry over the last couple of years. And so now the new gold mining industry is emerging much more leaner and able to, I think, profit very much from what lies ahead. Now, we're also seeing mergers and acquisitions picking up in the space. And I think we'll see even more of that, but especially mid-tier companies that are in good jurisdictions or some of the juniors that have ounces in the ground that look like they're going to be very profitable, and there's room for a lot of growth of the deposits. Kaminak Resources went recently. They were bought out. And this is something that I think we'll continue to see over the course of this year. Always in the gold market, you see the majors moving first and then the mid-tier, and then it moves down the food chain to the juniors. And what we're seeing now in the junior market is very, very significant. We're actually seeing juniors raising money on the markets again. And this is something that we haven't seen for 4 or 5 years. There were a lot of them. John Kaiser made a comment a couple of years ago that really half of the junior mining market needed to go away and would go away just because of the lack of interest from the general public in the mining sector. So we saw a lot of consolidation of juniors. We did see some going away, but we saw a lot of them cocooning and doing nothing over a number of years and just trying to keep the lights on. So now these companies are raising money and they're starting to explore, and some of them are actually generating some half-decent results. And that is attracting not necessarily the same investors who were around 5 years ago. I think largely it's a crop of new investors and maybe even some millennials who are getting into this market because they can't see yield. They can't see return anywhere. And the gold market is zooming ahead, and why not? So they're tending to get involved, and maybe not initially in a very large way, but starting to follow the gold market again. You know, every time we see a downturn, the media and the pundits say that gold is dead and it's not coming back, and always it does. It just takes a matter of time to work its way out. But I know, Jim, you want to address a little bit about gold supply going forward. Is that correct?
Yeah, because, you know, you and I talked about this in the last decade. There was a study done by Ralph Bullis about all the major gold fields, but it was very similar to what we saw in oil. You know, there are no more GAR wars. We're still with fracking and horizontal drilling and shale. You know, we're producing more oil today, but there are no big finds out there. Bullis was addressing this in the mining industry. I wonder if you would address that. Do you think, and maybe you can answer this, with the energy sector, shale, horizontal drilling, fracking really made a difference in producing more oil out of the ground. Keith, is there anything like that similar in the mining industry that could increase gold production, allowing companies to get more ounces out of every ton of ore they mine?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. There really is no new technology and nothing on the horizon that's going to allow us to find gold much more easily. People ask me all the time, can you spot this stuff from space, from satellites? And no, that is not the case at all. It very much takes boots on the ground and geologists and geoengineers looking around and finding the right thing. But we're also at a situation where a lot of what we call the low-hanging fruit has already been picked. And we're having to drill things at depth, geophysical and geochemical targets that are not at surface. It's getting harder and more expensive all the time. And not just that, though. More and more the NGOs and environmentalist groups are coming out against mining, and areas are being closed off that are potentially prospective for gold worldwide. So we see establishment of reserves, of national parks. We see governments that are sometimes rather hostile towards gold mining. And so the areas where the miners can prospect are shrinking all the time. Now, the one difference, though, of course, has been China. And China has now got a premier post as the largest gold producer in the world, but it would appear that most of it is kind of artisanal in nature, and a lot of the gold deposits are not things that are very, very robust in terms of long-term reserves, and they're not going to last too long. So we've seen, if it hadn't been for China And really the change by the Chinese regime towards gold and allowing companies within China to mine gold, if it hadn't been for that, we would have seen a precipitous drop in worldwide gold production. So the Chinese have made up the slack. But however, there is a lot of evidence out there, a lot of statistics that in 2017 we're going to hit the wall, and that worldwide gold production is really going to start to drop off. Now, remember, there was no exploration for almost 5 years. And so, on average, it takes about 10 years to get a gold mine permitted and getting it up and running. And so there's been, you know, really the seedbed for generating new deposits has not been there for 5 years. You know, gold deposits are finite resources. They get depleted and eventually exhausted, and then that's it. In South Africa used to be the biggest mining country in the world, gold mining country, and their deposits are getting old and tired. They're very, very deep. They're very expensive to operate. And this is what happens in the industry. Things just get used up. Ralph Bullis, you mentioned his study. He was working for Echo Bay Mines and did a study several years, or quite a few years ago now, but he was talking about a situation which is kind of similar to peak oil, but peak gold, where the deposits in the world, the easy ones, have been found, and it's just going to get harder and harder to find new quality deposits that are going to make a lot of money for companies. We're at a situation now where most deposits around the world are being exploited at a grade of about 1 gram per ton. For most of my career, 1 gram per ton was something that was what we call geologically anomalous, something of interest for companies, but certainly not going to be ore. So companies have had to start exploiting the low-grade envelopes of their high-grade deposits because that's all that's left now, or moving down the chain and mining things that really do not have very, very robust economics. Should the gold price, of course, continue on its path towards 2000 and above, we could see some of these deposits becoming economic. But remember, that's probably going to be fed by inflation, and inflation ups the cost of all kinds of things like concrete, structural steel, rubber tires, everything that goes into producing an ounce of gold. So it becomes more expensive, and the miners get squeezed. And this is what's happened before. So, it's just going to get harder and harder to find the quality deposits. About a year, maybe a year and a half ago, National Bank in Canada released a very, very good study, and they looked at the situation worldwide. And again, it looks like 2017, we're going to hit the wall. And then after that, we're going to see worldwide gold production continue on a downward path.
So, Keith, if we talk about the drivers today, we're seeing it with Brexit this Friday. Gold moved to the forefront. We're seeing it with negative interest rates around the globe. And so we have a lot of drivers for gold, which is the ultimate money. Let's talk about something. You mentioned the word inflation, and we see a lot of deflationary forces out there. And to me, you and I had a discussion on this a while back. We've seen inflation, but not in places that you usually see it. You see it in luxury goods. You see it in art paintings. You see it in, let's say, luxury real estate, expensive homes, Manhattan apartments, fine wine, collectible coins, luxury cars. So we've seen inflation, but we've seen it because where the big money has been going are these luxury items where we have seen inflation.
Yeah. Well, I think it is big money, but I think some of it is also smart money. So a lot of it, you know, the media likes to focus on things like Louis Vuitton handbags and stuff like that. But I think a lot of it is actually going into collectibles. It's going into real estate because people think that it's going to appreciate in value. So this is not that necessarily Hollywood types and dumb money being thrown around. I think a lot of it's actual smart money, and that's what's driving some of these markets. So, you know, eventually it's going to start moving down the chain again. I keep talking about the chain, but it will move down the chain, and we will see inflation in just normal everyday items. And we see this right now actually in a very pernicious way, and you've talked about this certainly on your program before. Things like cereal boxes decreasing in size but being the same price. Chocolate bars decreasing in size but remaining the same price. So you're getting a smaller unit per dollar spent, and this is very inflationary. It's not something that's really overt, and you have to think about it. But, you know, if you look around, you'll see this in almost all different facets of life right now. Little surcharges coming in on fuel charges for shipping, for instance, for air travel, you know, and all kinds of stuff like this. So I do think that there is inflation out there, but it's inflation that's not really reflected in the CPI. I think if you were to ask almost any man in the street, is it costing more money today for you to live than it did last year, they'd all say yes.
You know, it's interesting because you do see that, and it doesn't get recorded in the CPI. If your taxes go up on your cable bill, on your utilities, on your medical insurance, it's amazing how those things aren't recorded. But let's talk about some of the catalysts for gold going forward. We know that, as you just mentioned, that production is going to be very difficult to ramp up in many ways, given the lack of investment in the industry, similar to what we are seeing occur in the energy industry. We have negative interest rates, and it doesn't look like that's going away soon because already the Fed has opened up its doors for currency swaps. Central banks stand on the ready to flood the markets with money if need be. And also, you know, the one thing that we've seen is some of the limits. In fact, there's been two books written about this. One of them, Mervyn King, the former head of the Bank of England, and the limits to monetary policy. And monetary policy works best with fiscal policy. So the likelihood of a helicopter drop is the Fed's next move or other central banks' next move, to me, becomes highly probable because, you know, just have the government spend money, issue checks, and just have the Fed to print it. That way you know you're getting money into the economy and it becomes more inflationary.
Exactly. And in fact, there was a referendum very recently which was defeated in the country I live in Switzerland, which was directed towards really a helicopter drop of money, though the number wasn't completely firmed up, but it was roughly about $2,500 per month per every man, woman, and child in the country. And nobody really openly discussed how that was going to be financed. Obviously, it would completely destroy the credibility of Switzerland, and Switzerland is a country that has in the past, even though they've sold half their gold reserve, they have believed in sound money, and this is one of the reasons why the Swiss franc is regarded as a safe haven currency. So I do think that the helicopter drop of money is coming. I think that the central banks are running out of tricks, out of their bag of tricks to stimulate economies. So, you know, in the past we've seen under the Bushes there were tax rebates to people. And this is simply going to be, well, who knows how they're actually going to implement it or phrase it, but essentially it will be just giving away free money and printing it. So this has been discussed by Draghi for the EU. It's been discussed by a number of other countries. Finland's talking about it right now. And it's really, think about it, it's a pretty wacky move. It really is pretty crazy. If you had talked to economists about this 10 or 20 years ago, they'd say you'd have to have your head examined. And even when the helicopter drop of money was first mooted, it was kind of a tongue and cheek thing. But, you know, I think it is going to become a reality. I think right now, if we see some real upheaval in the euro market, you will see a lot of buying of precious metals by the French, by the Germans, by the Italians, because culturally, these are people who have bought gold and invested in gold time and time again to protect themselves from currency upheavals. You know, in the last century, the French currency went to zero 5 times. Of course, we're all familiar with what happened with the Weimar inflation in 1923, where the mark, there were 12 zeros attached to the mark worth $1. It was a crazy, crazy time. And of course, a number of other countries in Europe have experienced this. The British don't really have that much of a tradition, a recent tradition of buying gold, but certainly the other countries do. And in Switzerland, all the time I see in Geneva and in Zurich, Europeans who are spending their euro notes and buying physical metal at the window in the various banks and walking away with either coins or bullion bars that they're going to go tuck away somewhere to protect themselves, obviously, from currency volatility. So I think, you know, we've seen a lot of buying by Russia, by China, by a number of Asian countries in the gold market. But I think you could see a real catalyst coming up and a lot of buying by, not so much by European governments, but by the man in the street, European consumers and people who want to protect their savings.
Well, certainly one of the interesting aspects about central bank policy, and we saw this, Keith, in February of this year when Japan went to negative interest rates, instead of stimulating the economy, there was a rush to buy safes so they could keep their cash in a safe rather than keeping it in a bank at a negative interest rate. And so there was a rush on safes, and the Japanese consumer was actually keeping their cash in buying gold. So there's obviously when there's a limit in terms of what central banks can do. And that's why I think we are going to see a strong case being made by whoever the next president of the United States is for a strong fiscal spending program, basically a helicopter drop, which is financed by a central bank, because QE, I think, has reached its limits, as proven recently with negative interest rates in Europe. It's not doing much for the economy, nor is it doing much for the economy of Japan.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think in America, what they're going to do, and Obama tried to do this, if you remember his shovel-ready projects, which never materialized, but I think the next president will be very much spending a ton of money on infrastructure. And this will be the helicopter drop of money. It'll just be phrased and spent in a different way. So, you know, I think it's coming. We are witnessing things in central bank policy, governments, unprecedented things. We've never seen anything like this. We've never seen experienced negative interest rates like this. Country after country is adopting negative interest. It's an incredible time. So, you know, I do think we're going to continue to have a lot of volatility. I think longer term, even shorter term, it's going to continue to be very bullish for the precious metals.
All right. Well, listen, Keith, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do, how could they do so?
Probably the best way to contact me or to read what I'm thinking is to go to my website. It's called straighttalkonmining.com. And I have a whole bunch of essays there that you can download and read at your leisure. I'll be adding something there very soon, and you can also read my biography and see what various companies I'm involved in.
Well, we'll see whether or not they ever get London rebuilt, Jim. London has fallen, so we'll see where that goes. It's going to be interesting now, because now you have a 2-year frame on the Brexit, on the negotiations to get out of the European Union and strike some deal. There can be a lot of machinations that go on in the background during that one. Anything else that we've got focused on? It will also be interesting to see whether or not our elections in November echo what just happened in Great Britain.
Yeah, I think in the next couple weeks, we're going to be looking at corporate earnings to see what is happening on the top line with corporations. So we're going to be watching that. If corporate earnings reflect the weak economy that we're starting to see, the economic numbers, we're going to be paying close attention to them. As we said earlier, the IMF just reduced their economic growth forecast. NIBOR is saying the risk of recession is risen. So there are a lot of things that are happening that are showing a weakening economy, and we'll see if that plays into the fall's election. So we're going to be monitoring that. And John, we're also going to be seeing what happens with Europe. Now that the Brits have left, I guess the next question is, who's next? And I got a feeling it's not just going to be Britain. There are going to be other countries that are going to be leaving. So we are in the new normal. Maybe it's the new volatility that we're going to have to get adjusted to. All that will be coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.